Oh, what great news. Ever been angry? Murderer? Ever lust? Adulterer? Divorced? Adulterer? Ever swear? I don't mean the four-letter words, but used God to validate what you're saying? Condemned. Great news. Yet I think by shocking like this, Jesus is so intent to build the beloved community that he's willing to offend to do that. I think of the prophets, Amos, let justice roll down like a mighty river and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Or a few weeks ago, Micah, what does God require but to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with God? Last week, the prophets, what fast does God desire but to share our bread, to break the yoke, to set those oppressed free? And in today's reading, choose life. Choose life. This is what Jesus has come to offer, the reign of God. God's kingdom is among us. Repent. James Baldwin said that people are in history, and history is in them. This world that we live in, that's broken and fragmented, that's spiraling down toward rising temperatures, ocean temperatures, rising hate and exclusion and partisanship and party politics, that we rarely see each other. Our world seems to be ablaze, and into the midst of this, like into the midst of the world that Jesus came, the cry for justice, for mercy, for goodness, for life comes in. He's recruiting, and the Sermon on the Mount is a manifesto of the reign of God. He's inviting us, enlisting us to be part of a campaign of life in the midst of a culture that has made a covenant with death. And to do that requires everything. Jesus, in last week's reading, talked about the importance of the law, not the tiniest letter, a yod, not the tiniest stroke that distinguishes one letter from another semantically. Not one will pass away till everything is fulfilled. It matters. It matters because unless we get the Torah right, unless we understand what God requires, how do we choose life? If, in Hebrew, if God calls us to righteousness and to justice, Isaiah in chapter 5 plays with this. God desires justice, but what's given is bloodshed. God desires mishpat, justice. He gets bloodshed, mishpach. Desires righteousness, tzedakah. Gets tzedakah. That's why it's so important to make sure that we get the Torah right so that our own pursuit of justice and righteousness doesn't end up in bloodshed and a cry of distress. I think of many within this community. How many of you who've been divorced long ago, before the church has changed its rules, felt like a pariah, and whatever suffering that you held in your hearts before, it got even more. Your broken heart is now weighed down by condemnation of an ecclesial community. And if you're gay or lesbian or trans or bi or anything that doesn't fit the normal pattern, how long have you felt excluded? Or if your skin color is different, if you're disabled, not that long ago, if you were a woman. The following of the law and the way that it's interpreted could bring untold pain and anguish. And what Jesus is saying is the justice that God demands is not just us, for our tribe, for our group, for our color, for our political party or theological bent, but God's justice must be for everyone. And so when he says in last week's readings that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, and they were punctilious. They loved too. You will in no way enter into the reign of God. And what is the excess? Their holiness, their righteousness, drew narrow and narrower circles of who's included. Their understanding of the purity codes were to separate us from them. And Jesus says, no. He's come to do what no one else has been able to do before, that if in the garden Humpty fell off the wall and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again, that's what Jesus came to do, to heal a fractured, broken humanity, so that there are no longer us and them, but that the them over there are welcomed into this community, are invited to choose life, to experience life. And how we, who are called to be light bearers, respond to the them over there makes all the difference. Our response can exclude them or bring them in. And so in today's reading, Jesus wants to get at that more that takes us to the inside place in our hearts, that brings us to the gradual hymn that we all sang, to take a look at the walls and the barriers and the holes inside, to be able to, when confronted with something that hurts, respond in a way that is truthful, that puts up appropriate barriers, that calls out evil for evil, but does it in a way that keeps the door open to welcome the other in. So this conversation on anger, do you mind if I go there a little bit? Is that okay? Why does Jesus become so anal that anger becomes murder? That looking at someone from someone sexually desirous becomes adultery? If you're angry, it leads to judgment. But that anger can so easily lead to insult. That insult can so easily lead to contempt. And that contempt can so easily lead to erasing the other person, erasing them out of my mind, out of my life, out of their life too. If I respond in anger and you respond in anger, and we blast out or insult another, how do you think the other person is going to respond? And then when they respond, how do you think we're going to respond in return? And so the dance of anger keeps spiraling down and down until we may as well have excluded each other, either by you're dead to me or kill him. It's a slippery slope, and one that is so easily taken because anger is such a powerful emotion. So, Jesus says, when you feel the anger, stop. Stop and don't react. Respond. With the history that's inside of us, we've learned that when we get pushed, we push back. But what if we push back in a way that doesn't answer in kind, that changes the conversation, that opens the door for the possibility of reconciliation? So important is this, that Jesus says if we're worshiping and we're alienated, we leave the gift at the altar and go and be reconciled. Because the purpose of worship is to knit a broken community together around a table. And to gather here and to continue to fragment, it's a parody. That's why Paul comes unglued with the factionalism in Corinth. Healing matters. We're called to build the beloved community. Later on in the gospel, in chapter 5, Jesus goes on to say, not only not to show anger, but if we're struck on the right cheek, if we have our coat taken, if we're forced to do the second mile, we're to respond in a way that opens the door for the other to receive and accept their humanity, and for us to reclaim our agency and humanity. And it's in this context that we're called to love our enemies. Does that make sense? Not really. So let me go on to lust, which is a wonderful thing to talk about in a sermon. I don't think Jesus is saying there can be no fantasies. I don't think that Jesus is saying there can be no anger. But what do we do with the anger? What do we do with the fantasy? When that strong emotion comes, what do we do with that? Martin Luther once said of temptation, which these strong emotions can be, "I can't keep a bird from flying over my head. Can't keep the anger from coming. Can't keep that rush of hormonal desire from flooding my system. But I can keep the birds from building a nest in my hair. I can't keep from nurturing it." And I think what Jesus is inviting us to do when those strong reactions come, or those strong emotions come, to stop, to pause, to consider what happens next. There's a song that the Abbott brothers sing, and one of the lines in there is, "Angela became a target as soon as her beauty was seen by young men who tried to reduce her down to a scene of an X-rated screen." And then the question, is she not more than the curve of her hips? Is she not more than the shine on her lips? Does she not dream to sing and to live and to dance down her own path without being torn apart? Does she not have a heart? In the moment of hormonal temptation, the danger of just seeing a full human being reduced to the curve of hips and shine on lips, and not see how she feels or he, their humanity, their dreams, their desires, and what happens next. The same thing is true with anger. What happens next when the anger flares? To what end? And even if we fight, if that to what end is to build a beloved community, it determines how we fight. It determines if we throw the coffee cup against the wall or hit or say things that we cannot walk back. To pause, to stop. The only reference in the Bible that I know of that encourages us to be angry is in Ephesians 4, where the apostle says, "Be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Don't nurture it. Don't hang on to it. Deal with it appropriately." Then it says, "Don't give the devil room or a toehold." Pause, stop to think. And I think of a song that Fred Rogers sings. "What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing seems quite right? What do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or dough? Do you round up friends for a gang of tag or see how fast you can go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong, and be able to do something instead." And think of this song. "I can stop when I want to. I can stop when I wish. I can stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and to know the feeling is really mine. To know that there's something deep inside me that helps me become what we can. For a girl can someday be a woman, and a boy can someday be a man." To stop, to draw on those resources inside, to see the full humanity of the other, and then to respond in kind, to choose how we respond. I'm going to close with this. Since this is Black History Month, Nelson Mandela, when he was in prison, he trained himself as an athlete trains, because he realized he wanted to understand the other, because he wanted to change the world. He didn't want revenge. He wanted apartheid to end. And to do that, he had to understand how the other thought. And over time, he realized that if he wants to change, he can't make them feel more anxious, to have anger coming at them. That if they feel respect, then they can hear the wrong that's being done. And then when he walked out of prison, he turned around and said, "Unless I give up the bitterness in my heart, even though I'm free when I walk through those gates, I will always be a prisoner." Martin Luther King Jr., the same thing. His famous speech on the Washington Mall, the "I Had a Dream" speech. The country was on the verge of a racial civil war. It was hot and sweltering. Too many lynchings, too many beatings. And he begins his speech, and he says, "We're gathered here. Things are wrong." He names the wrong, but he does it in a way that opens a door for the future. He talks about a bad check being given to them. He talks about 100 years after this promise has been given, we still are not free. He talks about the suffering. Then he goes and talks about how people want to revolt, and he cautions. And then he pivots. He thinks about the what next. What happens after the truth is spoken and the anger is expressed? And he pivots, and he invites both blacks and whites to share a dream together. "I have a dream that our children, black and white, can play together. That on the red dirt of Georgia, justice can be done. I have a dream." I think what Jesus is inviting us in these texts to do is to dream, to realize that our emotions need to be schooled, that we need to deal with those hot things that flash up, and to pause, to stop, like Fred Rogers invites us to, and consider what next. And in that pause, to allow the Spirit to give us the creativity to respond in a way that deep justice, healing justice, life can enter. May God give us grace to stop when we need to speak when we need to in such ways that heal. May we choose life. Amen.